From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, State of the Union, no joyride, a southern chill, Ben Bernanke bowing out, and a death penalty push in the Boston Marathon bombing. On Tuesday night, President Obama said he'd go it alone if need be, and called on Congress to vote in a $10.10 minimum wage.
So join the rest of the country. Say yes. Give America a raise.
Republican Congressman Michael Grimm of New York, a little hot after the speech, told a reporter he'd break him in half like a boy, throw him off the balcony. He later apologized.
I'm sure my Italian mother is going to, you know, be yelling at me saying you weren't raised that way, and she's right.
And a deep freeze in the South. Chaos in Georgia. Thousands abandoned their cars on iced highways. Here's one angry citizen.
Why did they not mobilize the National Guard sooner? Why weren't they more prepared for this?
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, David Wessel of the Brookings Institution and Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What did you think of the State of the Union address? What's Ben Bernanke's legacy? Yay or nay on a Tsarnaev death penalty? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington is Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News. We saw her chase down Michael Grimm this week. Kelly O'Donnell, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And from Washington, David Wessel, now director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution, longtime economics editor at the Wall Street Journal, now a contributing correspondent there. David Wessel, welcome. Great to have you here.
And it's good to be with you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kelly, and David.
Here's the president at the podium, State of the Union. America does not stand still.
America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do.
Won't stand still, maybe not. David Brooks, conservative columnist, says he's managing the stately decline of his presidency. Charles Blow, liberal, says President didn't ask America to dream as much as adjust to the paralysis. What did you hear from that podium on Tuesday night, Kelly?
Well, I had the privilege of being in the chamber, so I had the experience of being in the room and then later watching the address a second time to get more of the televised view. And I think both of those critiques are, in essence, on point. I think the president had a very minimal set of goals, but at the same time wanted to address in a crisp fashion the paralysis that does exist. America not standing still is something that does resonate with people on both sides of the aisle. And yet, how do you break through? So I think he stated the problem more than stating the solutions. He can use his executive authority in certain ways. I was also struck by a more conciliatory tone toward Republicans than we have heard in the past. And I think some of them appreciated that as well, if there is a way to work together. The country wants that. People are tired of the fighting. And so I think the president had a gesture in that direction. I think we'll have to see how Republicans respond. But their initial sense of let's do work together is something they're talking about. There are a lot of specific steps where we can judge them on that going forward. But it was not a big sweeping speech for the fifth State of the Union. It was a way of sort of saying where we are. And I was struck also by how many fewer Americans actually watched it, which disappoints me.
Well, of course, I mean, in television, you've got to be disappointed, but then just for participation.
Yes, as an American, I mean that, not as a broadcaster.
Point taken, in a time of paralysis, I guess it's not exactly surprising. Conciliatory from the podium, on the road a little less so. Here he was yesterday talking with CNN's Jake Tapper. This was at a GE factory in Waukesha, Wisconsin, part of his post-State of the Union tour, included stops in Maryland and Pennsylvania, Tennessee, said the country, that he, contrary to criticism, had not diminished his ambitions.
In no way are my expectations diminished or my ambitions diminished. But what is obviously true is we've got divided government right now. The House Republicans in particular have had difficulty rallying around any agenda, much less mine.
Any agenda, much less mine. David Wessel, the president, talking up some parts of the economy's performance, but pointing, in his view, to big problems still with inequality and more. Just in terms of efficacy, David, the president using executive orders and the levers at his own control can do how much to address the economic continuing doldrums that we're in some ways seeing?
He can do very little with executive control. And in fact, it's not clear what he could do, even if he could get legislation through that would make a big difference in the short run. I think he's trying to make the best of a bad situation, take advantage of the fact that there does seem to be sentiment in the country to raise the minimum wage. Unable to get Congress to do it, he did the very symbolic thing of raising it for some employees of federal contractors.
Right.
I think part of what he's been doing here is trying to explain to people that we have both a short-term problem and a long-term problem. The long-term problem involving stagnation in wages, a widening gap between winners and losers in the economy, and so forth. It was striking to me that in previous speeches, he's been much more thoughtful about that and what he might do about it than he was in the State of the Union. I think that, you know, it was a long speech. I didn't watch it in the chamber. I watched it on my couch. And at one point, my wife accused me of falling asleep, but I would plead.
Hey there, big boy. Eyes open for the president with a speech, or ears anyway. Jack Beatty, what did you hear on this night from this president, fifth State of the Union, a year since his second inauguration?
Well, you know, the speech is being compared to Bill Clinton after the Republican takeover, the Bill Clinton move towards small ball. You know, President Obama derided Clinton's move at one time, calling it, you know, I don't do school uniforms. Well, in effect, he's saying, I do school uniforms now. But what people miss about the Clinton experience, and this is brought out very well by Amanda Turkel in the Huffington Post, is that Bill Clinton, in his 96 State of the Union, this was just after the first Republican shutdown of the government, mm-hmm. he singled out a hero, a Vietnam veteran who had gone into the federal office building in Oklahoma City and I think saved three or four women, pulled them out while the place was burning all around him. And then so the whole place erupted in applause. And then the president said, but Richard Dean's story doesn't end there. And he went on to say that just that past November, he had been helping Social Security recipients file for their benefits, even though he was not being paid because the Republicans had shut down the government. And then the president said, on behalf of Richard Dean and his family and all the other people who are out there working every day doing a good job for the American people, I challenge all of you in this chamber, never, ever shut the federal government down again. That was President Clinton putting that, and the clip showing Speaker Gingrich sitting behind him practically exploding with embarrassment. And, you know, there was none of that from the president. He didn't point out that last year he had 41 different things he asked them for. They did two. They reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act, good, and they did not default on the national debt, good. Those are the two things they did
but
out Jack, of the 41.
Jack, if he asked about that, if he points that out, doesn't he look even more ineffectual?
Well, yes, but he could also say, look, here's how different the country would be if those things had passed. We'd have, you know, early childhood education. We'd have a minimum wage increase. We'd have, you know, paycheck fairness for women. He could have gone down and said, you know, folks, all of those things are on the ballot again come November. Give me a Democratic Congress and you'll get them. He didn't do it.
I want to hear from our listeners. Tom, yes, David, please.
I feel the president's a little bit damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. Mm-hmm. If he's confrontational, he's accused of not being conciliatory to the Republicans.
Polarizing.
If he tries to be conciliatory to the Republicans, people say he's lost some spine. I don't think that the success of this presidency will depend on the president's oratory, as impressive as it is. The frustrating thing is he does not seem to have a Lyndon Johnson-like way of dealing with the realities on Capitol Hill, as frustrating as they are.
I mean, Kelly, to that point, here we are 5 years in. There has been such opposition, so deep and bitter, and yes, shut the government down and all the rest. But at a certain point, with all of that and the critiques that go very deep around it, it comes back to the president to figure out a way, doesn't it?
There still is a complaint among Democrats, I'm not talking about House Republicans, Democrats, that the president has not engaged enough with the legislative process, with how deals are done, with building relationships. That has been a narrative throughout his presidency. Now, At the same time, I will tell you that House Speaker Boehner on certain issues like immigration would say it's probably better for the president not to speak about it too much in order to get work done as they are trying to do now on the Republican side. So again, that damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. But I think there has been a personality difference in how this president has approached Capitol Hill compared to some previous presidents. Sort of ironic since he was a member of the Senate, but he does not engage in the same way. There has been a turnover in his legislative liaison. There's a new person in that role now who comes from the Hill. She's got a lot more personal relationships on the Hill. Perhaps that will help on some level. The conversations go on, but a lot of the nitty-gritty has been missing. And the engaging on how do you accomplish legislation has been something that I have continually been struck by Democrats saying to me they wish the president were more engaged on. He rejects that criticism. It may be a style difference, a leadership style difference, but that is one of the elements that has put us where we are now, where there is it's one factor in the lack of accomplishment we see.
Jack Beatty, just a half a minute before the break, but 3 years to go here with that kind of dry tone. Where do you go from there?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of perhaps some markers for the future. I mean, he could say, you know, we could do this, we could do that, and we could do the other if we had a Congress that could work with me, if we had a unified government. I think beyond that, there's very little prospect. Perhaps on immigration, this is worth talking about.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Southern deep freeze, State of the Union, bye to Bernanke, and a death penalty push for alleged Boston Marathon bomber Johar Tsarnaev. David Wessel is with us, longtime economics editor with the Wall Street Journal, now at the Brookings Institution, contributing correspondent at the Journal. Kelly O'Donnell's here, congressional correspondent for NBC News. Jack Beatty's here. I've got to just ask about the we'll-go-it-alone approach the president's describing here. If Congress won't help me, there's a lot we can do with executive orders. That got pushback from Republicans. Here's Ted Cruz, Republican Senator Texas, talking to CNN on Tuesday. Criticizing the president's use of executive orders and unilateral changes, he says, to laws.
We have never seen a president in the history of our country who, when he disagrees with a law, simply says he will not enforce it and unilaterally decrees changes to it. When he didn't agree with immigration laws or drug laws or welfare laws, he said his administration will not enforce them anymore.
Kelly O'Donnell, I'm looking at a big report here from Politico today saying, yes, indeed, this president has, with regulation and executive order, pushed well beyond, not in his number of executive orders, but in the significant scale and number of regulatory interventions, that he's sort of putting this administration in a class of its own. Do Democrats see that as well? Do you see that as a partisan critique? Is there truth in it?
I will tell you that in covering Congress for several years now, one of the things that I hear often is that it is a co-equal branch of government. And while our sort of culture and society looks at the president as the obviously singular leader, but we emphasize the power of the presidency more in just the way we sort of look at the world. On Capitol Hill, those who are elected to serve there feel very strongly about that balance of power. And so I do hear Democrats make a similar critique. Now, Ted Cruz comes with all of the things that are Ted Cruz when he outlines that sort of a critique. But there are concerns about it. At the same time, I think there are lawmakers in both parties who believe that the president should flex his muscle within the executive authorities he does have, should try to use power where he can, and that's a leverage point on its own. At the same time, it is hard for Democrats to say that the president shouldn't do these things when there has been the kind of inaction we have seen from Capitol Hill. So it is the ongoing sort of arm-twisting and tug-of-war of power, but it's a legitimate question, and of course the president is a not only a lawyer, but he was a constitutional law professor. He understands the dimensions of these arguments as well. It is a way to use power, and by using that power, it also can be a point to encourage Congress to do its job and to act on issues, to use the muscle that it has.
Of course, he's governed in a time of economic crisis, fair enough. Here's Politico David Wessel saying, already the president's team has enacted 300 economically significant regulations, far more than Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, or Ronald Reagan did in comparable periods. What about the use of that lever, David?
Well, Democrats in general like to use the regulatory lever, and when they were out of power for 8 years, the president appointed regulators who believed that they should use their power. I don't find these counts of regulations very meaningful. I mean, there's some that are serious and some that are not.
Yep.
But here's one big example is that the Dodd-Frank law, which some Republicans voted for, created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
And that agency was charged with coming up with a whole lot of regulations to prevent us from having the kind of crisis that we had before and to protect consumers. And they are implementing the law that Congress passed. So is that a knock on the president? That doesn't make any sense to me. On the other hand, I think you can understand why members of Congress are a little uneasy. The Obamacare, Affordable Care Act passes. It's got a lot of problems. There's so much partisan divide in Washington. They can't tinker with it legislatively. Mm-hmm. So the president seems to look at it as, well, I'll enforce this section and change this one. And it does seem a little bit more like a monarchy there at times.
Let's go to Carl in Calumet, Michigan. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Say, I heard your guest mention that the president is a constitutional scholar. And regarding the going it alone and the proposed action executive orders, I'd be curious to see or to hear what his discussion would be on the constitutionality of the long list of executive orders that he and, frankly, even previous presidents have been issuing. I would propose that the founding fathers would be rolling over in their graves if they could see what was going on today.
Too much executive order, a little whiff of monarchy. Jack Beatty, what do you say? He's up against it here. He's got nothing, as you point out, from Congress. On the other hand, there is a spirit in the Constitution that wants, you know, both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue working together.
Yes, and the Supreme Court now is deciding on a case about his recess appointments. You know, did he were these in violation of the Constitution? Was this an example of the sort of monarchical reach that David talks about? We have the mother of all regulatory battles and executive actions coming up, I think, in June, when the EPA is going to start issuing its regulations about power plants. That is going to be a huge deal. And I think the Republicans are laying the predicate right now for that fight, and they're going to connect it with this argumentation about executive overreach. But there, the president has court authority to act, as he doesn't in some of these other places, since the Supreme Court did rule that legislation like this or action like this could be regulated under the Clean Air Act.
Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, what do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Most of the commentary I've heard about the State of the Union reminds me of beachcombers strolling the beach at high tide saying not much is happening and failing to notice that the tide has changed. I thought that the big themes from that State of the Union address are that, first of all, the president's not going to play on the Republican side of the field anymore when it comes to deficit reduction. The deficit, as he pointed out, is at its lowest since the Eisenhower administration as a percent of GDP, and now it's time to boost people's incomes. So that's a sea change. Also, he's not going to be waiting for Republicans to try to sign on to any legislation. He's going to act where he can with congressional power that's been granted to him under many, many statutes. And thirdly, he's not going to play Al-Qaeda's game when it comes to foreign policy. We're not going to see endless wars. We're not going to see massive incursions. We've reaped the benefit of it already in the fact that we don't have troops on the ground in Syria, and we're at the negotiating table with Iran. These are major themes, and I'm surprised that most commentators have been focusing on who got a shout-out in the audience or how many times he said this or that.
Mark, we've got it. You like the way the president's still leaning. Of course, I guess there's the question of how effective he'll be even in his lean. Al-Qaeda's game, I don't know. How long are we going to be in Afghanistan? That's in the air these days. Let me get one more right here from Nashville. Paul, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
One of the things that we're concerned here, especially as a business owner, is the administration's naive view about the economy without consultation from top economists in the nation.
On what front, Paul? Are you talking minimum wage, or where's your concern?
Yeah, that's right. So the idea is that raising the minimum wage will certainly lead to job cuts. Certainly, I'm looking at that if that were to happen. How about the idea of creating new jobs through improving the infrastructure?
Well, I mean, I think they tried that, didn't get too far with Congress. But David Wessel, how about it? The president is putting minimum wage hike really front and center here. Give America a raise. And there's a lot of, on the one hand, it's low. And people say, we've got inequality and you can't live on that. And it will be spent quickly and it will help the economy. On the other, here's Paul saying, I'll lay people off. Net loss.
Right. So that's the argument about the minimum wage. Are there more winners than losers? If people get more money, they spend more money, that's a win-win for the economy, even if businesses have to make less money. Or is it a lose situation because so many people lose their jobs that it won't be a net benefit? There's a big argument among economists. The president has chosen the argument that there are more winners than losers. And that's influenced by the fact, as you say, that the minimum wage hasn't kept up with inflation over the last 20 years. It's actually done better lately than it did in the 80s. And that in many states, raising the federal minimum wage wouldn't matter because they already have wages
their own raise. Yeah.
But could I respond a little bit to the very good caller about the deficit?
Yes, please.
I think he makes a very good point, but I think the sea has changed on the deficit, if you will, and neither Republicans or Democrats intend to do anything about the deficit for the next couple of years. For two reasons. One is the measured deficit. Today's deficit has come down as the economy got better, as they raised taxes at the beginning of last year, as they sort of stumbled into spending cuts with a sequester. And even the long-term view has gotten a little better because healthcare costs have been rising more slowly. So the deficit has really fallen off the table as an issue. And it was so hard for them to deal with the real deficit issues anyways, like what to do about Medicare and Social Security and tax reform, that they seem to have, both sides have seemed to push that to the side and they're going to worry about something else. It's not only the president who's doing that.
Time out on deficit. Immigration got its nose back under the tent this week from the Republican side. It was interesting. Republican House retreat in Maryland. Here was Speaker of the House John Boehner talking about a GOP approach to immigration reform, sidestepping a path to citizenship. But something's in the works here. Kelly, we'll ask you. Here's Boehner.
This problem's been around for at least the last 15 years. It's been turned into a political football. I think it's unfair. So I think it's time to deal with it. But how we deal with it is going to be critically important. And that's why doing immigration reform in a common sense, step-by-step manner helps our members understand the bite-sized pieces.
Kelly, bite-sized pieces from the speaker. What's coming from the GOP on immigration?
Well, this really gets at the heart of how House Republicans look at the ways of legislating differently. Now, you remember the Senate passed a bipartisan immigration bill, and it was like 1,200 pages, and it was comprehensive, dealing with many aspects of the immigration issue. And House Republicans believe that that is just too much, and that there is evidence, like in the health care law, for example, that a big, big, big bill is fraught with problems in terms of what it actually means once life begins to implement that law. So what they want to do is take piece by piece, border and interior security as one piece, reforming the visa system so you can encourage high-skilled immigrants to be able to come here and work here. On the issue of citizenship, that is the thorny issue. Democrats believe you cannot have a two-tiered system in this country where you have endless legal status but not a way to become a citizen. Republicans view it somewhat differently. If they can give legal status to those who have been in the shadows, put through a series of steps where they would pay fines, learn English, those kinds of issues, that is a way to not give favored status to those who have been here illegally. Complex, difficult issues. And so House Speaker John Boehner says he believes the House must act on this and must pass aspects of this that would improve the overall situation but would not take on everything in one fell swoop.
Is there a compromise here that can be reached with enough votes to pass it, and does it tear the GOP up? There's a lot of resistance there.
Well, what's critical here is the president and Nancy Pelosi have signaled that they support the idea, or would live with the idea is maybe a better way to describe it, of going piece by piece. Within the Republican conference is where you'll find the biggest fight over path to citizenship. They may have to call it something else because that's sort of a politically charged term, but that's where a big part of the fight will be. But on aspects of this, whether it's visa reform or interior and border security, there could be some steps there. The DREAM Act, where children who were brought here and are living as Americans would have opportunities. Those kinds of issues seem to have some potential. Now, we've said that before. I think John Boehner wants to move on this. I think the temperature in the country has changed, and I think he has more credibility today than he did when this conversation became front and center earlier in his speakership, in part because we're in a post-shutdown world. I think there is more credibility behind his gavel today because of the way he won over some of the support of his more conservative House members. So we'll have to see. It's an election year. That makes it very fraught politically. But there does seem to be a will to move forward. But frankly, we've seen a will to move forward before. I do think this is a moment where there might be some progress on that issue.
I want to look at the farm bill as well, but we have to touch Ben Bernanke. The economy is sitting behind so many of these issues, certainly behind the State of the Union address. He is, today's his last day at the Fed, outgoing chairman. He talked earlier this month at the Brookings Institution about his time at the Fed.
I was so absorbed in what was happening and trying to find response to it that I wasn't really in that kind of reflective mode. I mean, later on, it was kind of like, if you're in a car wreck or something, you're mostly involved in trying to avoid going off the bridge. And then later on, you say, oh, my God, But
and that's where we've been. Ben Bernanke there on his way out. He's got tough critics. He's got big supporters. David Wessel, I heard Hank Paulson the other day saying, once again, this man saved the world from meltdown. What's the exit assessment of Ben Bernanke in your eyes, David?
I think you have to divide it in three pieces. In terms of preventing the crisis, he failed. And he's acknowledged this. He was part of the Greenspan era when the seeds of this crisis were sown. He doesn't think it was their low interest rates, but he admits that their regulatory policy was inadequate. And he misdiagnosed the problem initially. He didn't think it was going to be as bad. The second phase is handling the crisis, and there I think he's a hero. I think he saved us from a repeat of the Great Depression, and we learned how important it is, just as the president has the power to intervene in if we're under attack by missiles. It turns out that the only institution in our government that can intervene very quickly if we're under attack by financial missiles is the Federal Reserve. And then the third part, it's still kind of we don't know yet. All the things he did, keeping interest rates low, buying billions of dollars or trillions of dollars of bonds to try and get the economy moving again, that's more controversial. And we won't know for some time whether that was a plus or whether that created a set of problems that we can't yet see. But saving us from Great Depression 2.0, that's enough to give the guy at least an A- in my book.
You know, David, the way human nature works, you dodge a bullet, you forget the bullet. Hank Paulson clearly hasn't. But what... Give us some sense of when people talk about this meltdown, you say it could have been another Great Depression. What might that have looked like compared to what we saw? What we saw was pretty bad.
Well, we had 10% unemployment. In the Great Depression, we had something like 25% unemployment. The economy has been growing way too slowly, but it has been growing for 4 years now. And I think there's a strong case that if the Fed had not done what it did, the economy might not be growing now, or it would have been in a much deeper hole than struggling to get out of. So it's hard, it's hard for the Ben Bernanke to leave the Fed and the bumper sticker he would put on his car, and I understand he's buying a new one because he hasn't had a car while he was the Fed chairman,
okay.
is going to say, it would have been worse if not for me. And as Barney Frank once said, it's very hard to get reelected with that as your slogan.
That is a tough sell.
Yes, fair enough. But for those who peered into that chasm and vividly imagined what it might be, we can feel that he's going with a lot of gratitude. Not a perfect record, but that's a big save right there. David Wessel, please stand by. Kelly O'Donnell with NBC News, Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week, Daft Punk, Lorde, Macklemore, Ryan Lewis, big winners at the Grammys, and Queen Latifah married 33 couples, many of them same-sex, as Macklemore and Ryan Lewis and Madonna performed.
By the power vested in me by the state of California, I now pronounce you unmarried!
We are in new territory. Super Bowl Sunday straight ahead, Denver Broncos, Seattle Seahawks. The teams will play at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. In New York, CBS David Letterman wasn't exactly looking forward to the hometown game.
Because nothing excites New York football fans more than a team from the Pacific Northwest playing a team from the Rocky Mountains. I mean,
Come on. Bring it on.
And on Monday, legendary folk singer Pete Seeger died at 94. So many great songs. And Pete here on NPR in 2005.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn.
Singing together, you suddenly find out there's things that you can learn from each other which you wouldn't learn with arguments and which you might not learn any other way.
A time to mourn, a time to cast away stones.
Soundtrack of many childhoods, mine included. We're looking at a week in the news. David Wessels here, contributing correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and now director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. Kelly O'Donnell, congressional correspondent for NBC News, is with us. Jack Beatty's here. Listeners still thinking about Ben Bernanke on his way out the door. Jim in Dubuque, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think that Bernanke and Greenspan will be lucky if they're not strung up from the light posts when this economy collapses. The way that the government calculates inflation and GDP and employment has been altered since the early 80s. Inflation now is actually about 9% if you calculate it the way we always did. Unemployment is actually about 23%. We're in the eye of the storm. They've been creating larger and larger bubbles to prevent natural market corrections. And when the market collapses, we're going to find ourselves in the greater depression.
Jim, we've got it. David Wessel, pick it up right there. Changing the, you know, moving the goalpost, and we're headed over the cliff, and we'll have Bernanke and Greenspan to thank.
Well, it's worth remembering that when Alan Greenspan left office in 2006, he was a big hero, and he doesn't look so good now. So the caller makes a good point that it'd have to wait for time to pass. But I don't buy his diagnosis. I don't believe the government's tilting the numbers or somehow distorting what's going on in the economy. And I don't think there's any question, Bernanke has said it himself, that the job market sucks. And the unemployment rate has come down because so many people have stopped looking. And middle-class people aren't getting wages. Nobody's under any illusions about that. But there is a concern that are we in a period of time where the only way that the government can get the economy moving is to create bubbles? And that is the concern about what the Fed has been doing lately. Is the stock market going up, or it had been until the last few days? Are housing prices rising only because the Fed is flooding the economy with cheap money? And is that the only way that the economy grows? And have we gotten hooked on bubbles? That's a legitimate concern, but I'm afraid he's a little too pessimistic for my taste.
But that's a pretty scary concern. I mean, the president's saying, you know, if we just did things right, we're the best positioned country in the world for the 21st century. Oh, but maybe not. Maybe it's all built on bubbles and sand.
Well, that's true, but you could be the best positioned country in the 21st century and the whole world could have this problem.
I think
the president's right that we're well positioned to take advantage of the technological and globalization trends of the 21st century if we do things right and if we address the problems we have. But there are people, Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary among them, who are worried that we've entered a period of what he calls secular stagnation, where it'll all the efforts of the government to put adrenaline into the body economic will just manage to keep it alive rather than to get it to grow than the way in which we were used to in the past.
Good luck, Janet Yellen. Tim, outside Nashville, Tennessee. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a comment about the immigration reform. That's the old thing that everybody's been talking about for years and years. And I can't even understand why they would think about it for the simple reason of, you know, breaking the law is breaking the law, you know.
Yeah, but you got 11 or 12 or 15 million or I don't know how many people it is. I mean, at some point, don't you have to do something about this reality, Tim? These people are among us. They live with us. They're here.
That's true. But they're not supposed to be here. So, you know, if somebody keeps getting a DUI, you're going to keep giving them their license?
What?
We have so many people trying to get here legally and doing the right thing, and then you're just, you know, basically giving them a free pass to jump the fence.
Tim, let me ask you. I'm reading here you're a truck driver out of Alabama. If the Republicans do reform and allow legal status, where does your vote go, Tim?
Well, I am a Republican, and if they do reform, I'm just going to quit voting, I think. You know, it's like every time I vote somebody in there or whatever, they don't do what I want them to do. You know, they don't listen to the people, just like our president.
Tim. Tim, we've got it. Take care with your truck on those icy roads down south. Jack, I hear you there.
Well, I was just going to say, Tim reflects public opinion. In the NBC Wall Street Journal poll this week, huge majorities want an increase in the minimum wage. Almost 90% want an action on jobs and so on and so on. Only 39% want immigration reform. And many people, for the reason that, that Tim just gave, that these folks broke the law or they didn't get right. And then there's the economic argument. There aren't jobs for American citizens.
Part of the reform conversation is about updating the legal path that already exists, where immigrants from around the world are using that it has not been updated when it comes to visas and things like that. So that's part of the discussion, and maybe we haven't done a good enough job in explaining to people it's not just about those here illegally, but trying to also look at how to make a smarter system that is less rigorous in unnecessary ways, but also targets who should be at the front of the line, if you will. What skills from around the world should get visas? Not citizenship, but a right to be in the country to study or work here for some time. That's part of this discussion as well. And there, I think, is broad feeling in both parties that system of laws needs to be freshened up and retooled.
Tim, drive safe there. Joe in Columbia, South Carolina. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Joe. What's on your mind?
And thanks for taking my call. The Atlanta disaster this week.
All those cars in that little bit of snow and ice, right. And abandoned, and what a mess.
A complete mess. Well, you know, I don't know if this might have helped, but a couple of years ago, like in 2012, Atlanta, or the Atlanta metropolitan area, mm-hmm. had a chance to vote for a 1 cent penny tax to improve MARTA. That's their
rapid transit there, the train system,
right, transportation
more.
Transportation system, mm-hmm. right. But they voted it down. I mean, that's just flabbergasting to me. To me personally, that's absolutely flabbergasting. Because I think at least if that would have been working, perhaps less cars would have been on the road, and at least the disaster might have been minimized to some degree.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a big step, but they didn't take it. Maybe they didn't expect the weather. Maybe they didn't expect the climate. We heard the governor of Georgia saying they didn't have a heads up. I heard Al Roker on NBC, your network, Kelly, sort of dressing that down. So he had plenty of time to prepare for it. Let me get one more from down that way. Samantha in Columbia, South Carolina. Samantha, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I live in Columbia, South Carolina, as you said, and we got about 4 inches of snow. And somehow, with only 9 snowplows, our city managed to make sure that the roads and the interstates were pretty well taken care of, albeit it wasn't the best job that could have been done. I think we need to have more snowplows because we do see a decent amount of snow for this area and people are unprepared to drive in it. But the fact that the mayor of Atlanta is saying that that he wasn't prepared or like didn't have time and it was short notice, I mean, that's just ridiculous. And Atlanta has seen snow and ice before. I mean, they should have known better. It's really sad that the people had to go through that. And I think something more should be done other than just an apology.
Well, we'll see. It was certainly a mess. We were down in New Orleans a week ago and just a little bit of ice on the runway there. Flights canceled. When it pushes way down south, there's not as much equipment and preparedness. But, well, was this just way too little preparedness? I'm sure that debate's not over. Beth, thank you, Samantha. Beth in Schenectady, New York. Beth, you're on.
Yes, hi. Last week, doctors warned Congress not to cut welfare, food stamps. And so what did they do with this wonderful farm bill? They cut food stamps. So I do not see how this is going. They cut farm subsidies. Most farm subsidies go to people who are sort of cooperative farms, which sounds nice, but it's really corporate farms. So How is it all good for the country? Where is this? Just because we're moving forward doesn't mean that we're doing anything. And what's Congress going to say when people already food pantries are low? One of my part-time jobs, I teach creative movement and dance for an outreach program. And you know how many people we feed? I mean, it's outrageous. And you know what? The rules are already just to feed people who are starving and homeless.
Feeding people at a dance program, no less. And yes, there are cuts here. There were people who said, well, at last we finally got a bill. There were others who were very critical. Beth, here's a little tape from Jim McGovern. This is a Democratic congressman out of Massachusetts on the House floor.
This bill will make hunger worse in America, not better. If this bill passes, thousands and thousands of low-income Americans will see their already meager food benefits shrink. And for what? Why? to meet some arbitrary deficit reduction goal, to pay the cost of the giveaways and the crop insurance program, to pay for the sweetheart deals for the sushi rice growers and the peanut farmers and God knows who else?
It took a long time, Kelly O'Donnell. What should we see in this compromise farm bill?
Well, we expect that on Tuesday the Senate is likely to vote, and it is a massive bill. It covers a five-year spending and regulation, and it makes many changes that affect vast parts of our lives. Those of us who are city dwellers may not think of the farm bill in that way, but a big part of it is nutrition support in the way of the program that your caller was talking about. There are cuts to that. There had been increases leading up to it. There is a kind of heartbreaking debate over that. Those who believe that there should be no cuts feel very, very deeply about it. At the same time, in the sort of world of Washington Compromise, they are changing how they're dealing with paying farmers. Instead of direct payments to farmers, there will be enhanced crop insurance. It's far more complex than the time we have allows, but this is a debate over how to change government and its role in paying farming. And it has been decades in the making. And so advocates who believe in the bill think, and there are many Democrats as well as Republicans in this, believe that they are making progress. There are still those who believe too much money is being spent in ways that is not productive for the government to be involved in this industry. This is a tough one, and that's why it's taken so long. You'll see changes to dairy programs, which will prevent the milk cliff that we heard about where prices would shoot up. A lot of this is a web of regulation over decades. Different kinds of crops have different concerns. How do you bring a new generation of farmers into the process? And what do you do about these nutrition programs, which are an enormous part of what the Farm Bill is about? So there are cuts there, but there are also changes to the program that some advocates say will reduce some of the will create savings. But there is undeniably a debate over people who will say that this will take food off the tables of people who need it.
But it's going to put food on the tables of the 12 members of Congress who receive farm subsidies and now will receive crop insurance. In the original House bill, it mandated that members of Congress, cabinet secretaries, family members who receive such subsidies have their names printed in the bill. The final bill, amended by the House, remove that disclosure.
And this
statement
has been millions over the years.
Yes, millions over the years. One member, Stephen Fincher of Tennessee, over the last decade, $3,300,000 in subsidies. Didn't stop Mr. Fincher from standing up and decrying people who were, you know, dependent on the government for food stamps. So, yes, Congress took care of itself very nicely.
Jackie in Melrose, Massachusetts. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I agree with most Bostonians that the young bomber, that terrible thing that happened in Boston, he should not get the death penalty. And I want to commend your station, Tom, because at that time, afterwards, your station was the only one that actually interviewed him on why he did this. And he responded, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I never heard that anywhere else.
But you say no to the death penalty for Zhahar Tsarnaev. I appreciate your call, Jackie. Our time is short. We've got a lot of callers on that front. Let me try and get a couple more here. Thank you, Jackie. Karen, Newton, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on. What do you think?
Hello. I'm calling in memory of my dad and Pete Seeger, both of whom deplored the death penalty. Mm. I was 11 years old in California when it was announced in my class that Carol Chessman was executed, and children cheered. Is that what we want for our society? I'd like to hear the answer.
What about Zhahar Tsarnaev? What do you think of the Department of Justice saying this week they'll pursue the death penalty there? I guess that's not your way.
Death penalty for absolutely anybody.
Kelly O'Donnell, how do you interpret this decision by the Department of Justice to go for the death penalty in the Boston Marathon bombing case?
Well, as long as the death penalty is one of the tools that federal prosecutors have, it is hard to argue that a case that involved death and terrorism with a political motive would not fall under that. That's not to say that it should be pursued, but if you're the prosecutor and this is the case you're moving forward, Eric Holder has to review, is this a case that meets that standard? And I think that's where we're at. If the country is of a mood to end the death penalty, that is a larger discussion. This is a tool that prosecutors would use. It doesn't mean it will happen. I covered every day of the Oklahoma City bombing trials. And Tim McVeigh was given the death penalty. Terry Nichols, the co-conspirator, was not. He received life. It is a step in a process. It doesn't mean that would be the eventual end if he is convicted. But it's hard to say that if they have this as a potential penalty, if it does have some deterrent effect, which is a debate unto itself, it's hard for prosecutors not to put it forward given the circumstances we're looking at here.
So interesting for it to come into a state, Massachusetts, which leans so strongly against the death penalty. One more call. Our time is short, but Rick in Springfield, Massachusetts, I want to get you on. Just half a minute here, Rick. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to let folks know what a wonderful man Pete Seeger was. I had the honor of meeting him. He did a concert in a middle school in Springfield, Massachusetts, and was like having a conversation with my grandfather. Beautiful man.
You know, I couldn't agree more. He was on our show 10, 11 years ago. Just terrific. When you go back through the songbook of Pete Seeger, songs he wrote, songs he brought back, We Shall Overcome, Michael Row Your Boat Ashore, Turn, 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 If I Had a Hammer, and all the rest, for a generation of Americans of some stripes, that was right in the middle of it. What a beautiful, beautiful man. People sing together, communities get made, things get done. But not patty cake politics, this guy. He had a strong view of the world and so gentle and open. I'm glad you put that right out there, Peter. I appreciate your call. To our panel this week, Kelly O'Donnell with NBC News, David Wessel now at Brookings Institution, Jack Beatty, thanks to all of you. David, thanks for being with us.
A pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Kelly O'Donnell, wonderful to have you. And we didn't get back to you chasing Grimm down the hallway, though. The chastened Michael Grimm. I'll break you like a boy. That one was new to me.
That's never my favorite duty,
but boy.
If called upon, I will.
Well,
yeah. Is it on YouTube somewhere? Can
yes,
we watch
somewhere.
It?
You did it. You did. You did. Jack Beatty, thanks very much for calling.
Thank
for
you.
Being here. Listeners, this is On Point.